This episode's title exists somewhere in the digits of pi.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of the Beyond Podcast, the podcast that is also questing for the essence of mind and pattern. This is a podcast for anyone who has pointed a camera plugged into a TV back at the TV.
Hi folks, welcome back. My name is Vadim and I'll be your host again. Welcome to the podcast that discusses meta concepts. Thank you so much for sticking with this podcast for these last 10 episodes. Of course, we call this episode episode 9 because we started with episode 0, 0 being the first natural number. Let us start the 10th episode by looking at a passage from the Tao Te Ching, also rendered as Tao Te Ching. This is, of course, the classic text that serves as the basis of the philosophy and religion of Taoism, or Taoism. As always, this is not a podcast about religion or spirituality.
Which brings us back to our starting point, the 9 tenets of constancy.
Instead, we're going to start with an idea inspired by the text and explore a fun meta topic. The passage of interest is actually the two opening lines from chapter 1. I should note that there are many English language translations of this text, with every translator bringing their own influence on the choice of words and sentence structure. For example, the American author Ursula K. Le Guin, in her translation of the Tao Te Ching published in 1997, begins with, "The way you can go isn't the real way. The name you can say isn't the real name." Le Guin was a prolific writer. Her sci-fi novels and short stories have been very influential and won many awards. For Le Guin, the work of translating the Tao Te Ching was more of a personal passion project rather than something academic. The translation is meant to feel more contemporary and be accessible to modern English speakers. Let's look at another translation. The user-translated version of the text available on Wikisource renders the same passage as, "The Tao that can be stated is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name." This is somewhat similar to Le Guin's interpretation, and we should note that Tao, or Tao, the literal meaning of this word is the way. The Wikisource translation, along with many other popular translations, talk about describing the way, and Le Guin, more poetically, chose going the way.
How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man?
7.
Let us consider one more rendering of this passage from a 1958 translation by Archie John Baum, an American professor of philosophy. "Nature can never be completely described, for such a description of nature would have to duplicate nature. No name can fully express what it represents." This one is a bit more verbose, but it captures something that will be of interest to this episode. By the way, should we as readers care about the brevity of the Tao Te Ching in any language? Given a choice of several translations, should we pick one that uses the fewest words? I'm of course teasing here because we're going to quickly veer away from philosophy, but what I like about that last translation is the language about describing something. The philosophical implication is that a full description would necessarily be as large, by some metric, as the thing being described. So to describe nature would be to duplicate all of nature. Surely an impossible task?
Dude, there's a universe in all of us.
But what if we attempt a less lofty goal of not describing nature itself, but something a bit more accessible, such as strings? Strings are just sequences of characters from some finite alphabet, such as the letters A through Z, the digits 0 and 1, or the set of Chinese characters, such as those in which Tao Te Ching was originally written. For example, let us consider the string 00000111111. How would you describe the string? Well, in plain natural language, you might say, the string consists of 5 zeros followed by 5 ones. What about the string XYXYXYXYXY? Again, in English, you might say, XY repeated 5 times. What about 3.141592? Well, again, you could either go with 3.141592, or you could say the first 7 digits of pi. Now, this all seems straightforward enough. whatever natural language you speak, if you can come up with a reasonable description such that another speaker of the language can reconstruct the string exactly from your description, then your description works.
I get it!
Maybe some descriptions are too wordy? Doesn't matter?
Oh, now I get it!
Maybe you decided to get creative and chose to add some flair to how you describe a given string. For example, for the digits of pi, you could go with a popular mnemonic and give this description. Take the length of each word in the following sentence and write it down after the number 3 and a decimal point. I wish I could remember pi. Eureka, cried the great inventor. Okay, fine, get clever if you want. It seems like with the mnemonic expansion of pi, you're giving somebody more work because they have to count the letters in each word to reconstruct the original string. So which description of the string you prefer seems to be somewhat subjective. Do you go with something dry and obvious or something fun and creative? Something that might be easy to memorize because it flows like a poem, perhaps? So let's take the subjectivity out of the discussion and come up with a metric that doesn't depend on taste. What if we ask, what is the shortest description of a given string? Now, in the context of natural languages, this can be somewhat hard to pin down. For example, given our first example consisting of 5 zeros and 5 ones, let's examine a few different English language ways of describing the string. For example, a string consisting of 5 zeros followed by 5 ones. 5 zeros followed by 5 ones. 5 zeros, 5 ones. 0000011111. A string consisting of the binary digits 0000011111. 5 O's, 5 ones. Immediately we notice that some descriptions are more compact than others. For example, there's always a description that is at least as long by some metric as the string itself. This description specifies explicitly every character in the string and may also carry some meta information about the fact that it is meant to be a description of a string. However, if we allow for some implicit intent in these descriptions, we can drop the meta information and just focus on the contents of the string we're trying to describe. Even then, we can have a description that mentions every character in the string explicitly. However, if we notice some pattern in the string we're describing, perhaps we can use fewer words. For example, 5 zeros, 5 ones is a 4-word description of a 10-character string. What if we wanted to optimize further? 5 O's, 5 ones is also a 4-word description, but it can be written with 18 characters, including spaces, whereas 5 zeros, 5 ones requires 20 characters. Can we do better? And by better, I mean, can we come up with an even shorter sentence measured in either words or characters that nevertheless fully describes our string of interest? And at this point, it becomes easier to move away from natural languages and instead focus on computer programs. This removes a lot of the ambiguity about the intent of the description or whether a given description is easy to understand and replicate by a speaker of the language.
Still learning English? It's the language you speak.
So let's redefine a problem this way. Let's pick our favorite programming language and try to construct a program in that language that emits the desired string. For example, if we pick Python as our language, we can emit strings using the print statement. The Python statement print 00000011111 is a valid program that prints our string and halts or exits. This seems fairly concise, but can we do better? Telling the computer to print the entire string is basically equivalent to a human language sentence that individually specifies each character in the string. Another valid Python program is print 0 in quotes times 5 plus 1 in quotes times 5. This one takes advantage of a Python feature that allows us to multiply a string by a number to make it repeat. This representation actually saves us a single character over the first Python example. However, if the original string had more zeros and more ones, like let's say thousands of each, then using the multiplication trick would be quite economical over a representation that lists out every character. Now we can generalize. Given some string S, or Sierra, we can ask, what is the length of the shortest computer program? And in our case, we mean the shortest Python program that produces S. The size of the program in bytes or characters can be our measure of brevity. So the program print 0 in quotes times 100 is 14 bytes long. The program print 0000 and so on with 100 zeros is 109 bytes long. That's 100 bytes for the zeros and 9 more for the print statement, the quotes, and the parentheses. If this kind of measurement of strings relative to the programs that can produce them sounds familiar, then you may be familiar with the concept of Kolmogorov complexity. Kolmogorov complexity comes from the field of computer science and mathematics that concerns itself with algorithmic information theory. This field studies informational complexity of objects, which we can also think of in terms of entropy or in terms of patterns or maybe compressibility. Intuitively, an object that has an obvious repeating pattern, such as our string with a long run of zeros and ones, can be described in a form that is more compact or compressed.
Yes, yes, yes. You sound like a broken MP3.
However, the object we're describing could be something like the constant pi, or e, the base of the natural logarithm, or Champernowne's constant. We can write computer programs that emit strings up to some desired length that reproduce these constants. And the size of these computer programs can be quite short compared to the length of the strings that they produce. But our leading question here is, how short? And could they be any shorter?
Could I be wearing any more clothes?
Stated more generally, can we come up with a universal mechanism that takes in some finite length strings and outputs descriptions of those strings that are minimal, for example, the shortest possible Python program that reproduces a given string? Of course, for some handcrafted examples and with a deep knowledge of a given programming language, we could manually prove that certain programs in fact are minimal for a certain specific string. But now the goal is to fully automate the procedure. Can we come up with an algorithm that can do this for all strings? Thinking about this problem will give us a fundamental insight in algorithmic information theory. But before we discuss this result, let's revisit a fun puzzle from the previous episode. This was the so-called Blue Eyes puzzle submitted by listener Ed. What I found appealing about this puzzle is that it has a nice recursive solution, and it also touches on the concept of superrationality by Douglas Hofstadter, where superrational thinkers, when analyzing some strategy, take into account that they themselves are in a group of superrational thinkers. Yes, that guy again. In this puzzle, we started off with 100 blue-eyed people and 100 brown-eyed people, plus their green-eyed guru, all living on an island. Apart from the guru, these islanders are not allowed to communicate, and they have no reflective surfaces, so they cannot see the color of their own eyes. They also don't know the initial distribution of eye colors. For example, a given blue-eyed person would look around and see 99 blue-eyed people, 100 brown-eyed people, and their green-eyed leader, but that tells them nothing initially about their own eye color. The goal is to have everyone correctly identify their own eye color. This allows them to leave the island. Initially, everything is at a stalemate until the guru says, "I count at least one blue-eyed person who isn't me." It turns out that this little bit of information is enough to break the stalemate in a fascinating way, such that eventually all blue-eyed people can figure out their own eye color and leave. And if we add a constraint that apart from the guru, the islanders can only have blue or brown eyes, and everyone knows this, then everyone on the island can deduce their eye color and also leave. I really love how unintuitive this seems. When the guru says that they see a blue-eyed person, what does that really change? At the start of the puzzle, everyone could see that at least some of the islanders have blue eyes. The brown-eyed people can see all 100 blue-eyed people, and anyone with blue eyes sees 99 other blue-eyed people. So how is this new information relevant or helpful? This is what makes it so fun. So how do we solve this puzzle? I had mentioned that the solution is recursive in nature, meaning that we can start with a simpler version of the puzzle and then inductively prove that the solution scales up. So let's start with a minimal setup where there's exactly one brown-eyed and one blue-eyed person, plus the leader. When the leader says that at least one person has blue eyes, the sole blue-eyed person can immediately infer that it's them, since there is no one else on the island that appears to have blue eyes. The next day, that blue-eyed person goes to the ferry, that's how you get off the island, and tells the ferry captain correctly their own eye color. The following day, the brown-eyed person will see that the blue-eyed person has left. That means I must have brown eyes, he would reason. Otherwise, the blue-eyed person would not have made the deduction that allowed them to leave.
Eureka!
And so on that day, the brown-eyed person goes to the ferry and also leaves the island, having correctly stated their own eye color. Again, this would be the case for the variation of the problem where islanders can only have blue or brown eyes. Otherwise, just the sole blue-eyed person can go. Okay, so that's the trivial case. Does this work with two people of each eye color? Yes, it does. On day zero, if there are two blue-eyed people, their reasoning goes like this. And what we're about to say is symmetric for both of them. I see two brown-eyed people and one blue-eyed person. If I myself have brown eyes, then the blue-eyed person I can see is the sole blue-eyed person here, and they know this. Tomorrow they will be able to go to the ferry captain and leave the island. The next day comes, let's call it day one, but nobody leaves the island. Now each blue-eyed person will reason the following. The blue-eyed person did not leave the island, therefore they must have seen at least one other person with blue eyes. Since the other two people I can see have brown eyes, I myself must be that other blue-eyed person. Both blue-eyed people will immediately arrive at this conclusion, and on the following day, day two, they can both go to the ferry and leave. So now we have our base case of one, and the inductive step of two. Shall we go through the case of three blue-eyed people? Why not? On day zero, the guru makes her announcement. Each of our super-rational blue-eyed thinkers thinks the following. I know the solution to the problem when there are two blue-eyed people. I can see two blue-eyed people. If they are indeed the only two blue-eyed people, then they will both leave on day two. When day two arrives, and no one leaves, each can immediately conclude that there must be three people with blue eyes. On day three, they can go to the ferry and leave. And in the case of four people, the same applies. Knowing the solution to the three-person problem by knowing the solution to the two-person problem by knowing the solution to the one blue-eyed person problem allows everyone to synchronize their conclusions correctly. And this generalizes up to any N. In the case of 100 blue-eyed people in the original problem statement, nobody would leave until day 100, at which time all the blue-eyed people would go to the ferry and leave together. And again, if this is the version of the problem where you can only have blue or brown eyes, apart from the guru, then all the brown-eyed people can leave the following day. Otherwise, the game just stops there. Isn't this a neat problem? It requires some inductive reasoning, and it has this perhaps counterintuitive element of the guru's statement that gets the ball rolling, despite telling the islanders something that they technically already know. What do you think? Let me know at thebeyondpod@gmail.com. All right. Back to Kolmogorov complexity, and its discoverer, Andrei Nikolaevich Kolmogorov, or ANK as he liked to be called for short. Before we made a detour to talk about the blue eyes puzzle, we were discussing the problem of how to determine what is the shortest possible computer program that outputs a given string. For specific choices of string, we can certainly do the exercise by hand and state something like, this is the shortest possible piece of Python code that outputs the string ABC. But Andrei Nikolaevich was asking a more general question. Does there exist an algorithm that can emit such a program for any possible string? By the way, I have no idea if Professor K actually liked to be addressed by any specific nickname. It's just fun to imagine that AK would have appreciated a more compressed moniker than his full given name.
Is Seymour there? Last name. But
just a sec.
So now we get to revisit a topic discussed in several episodes of the podcast, notably episodes 3 and 8. This is the idea that computer programs can perform some kind of operation on other computer programs. Again, this should be very familiar if you've ever worked with a compiler or an interpreter. And if this sounds circular, don't worry. Just remember that computer programs, in the most abstract sense, take some input and produce some output while following some fixed set of rules. And the input can be really anything represented as some sequence of symbols. So an input to a computer program can just be another computer program written in some language. Similarly, the output of a computer program can be yet another computer program in some human-readable programming language or as the low-level instructions that can be executed by the CPU.
What I really need is a droid who understands the binary language of moisture evaporators.
So with that in mind, I wanted to talk about some fundamental insights about Kolmogorov complexity. So first, let us consider some specific string of interest. For example, the first billion decimal digits of pi. As you know, there are many algorithms for computing pi to some desired precision. I believe the current record stands at something like 10 to the power of 14 digits. I'm going to be somewhat less ambitious here with just a billion digits. So let's say we want to come up with some automated way to generate a computer program that calculates pi to this precision. And furthermore, we want the absolute shortest program in our programming language of choice that does the job. Well, here's one way we might try to do this. Let's call this algorithm the naive Kolmogorov complexity calculator. Keep in mind that just like many discussions about theoretical computability, this is never really about practicality, it's about what's possible in principle. So we start systematically generating bits of text that could be our desired shortest computer program for generating pi. These bits of text do not need to actually be valid programs, we're going to check for that later. We just need to ensure that we are generating these in such a way that the shorter ones come out ahead of the longer ones. For example, we can start with a possible computer program that is just a single character, like A and B, and so on. When we get through all of our valid characters in the programming language, we can then work through all the two-character strings, like AA, and then AB, and so on, and so on. In this scheme, we will evaluate all potential computer programs of length 1, then length 2, then length 3, and so on. As you can see, generating these candidates is trivial, but what do we do next? Well, next we perform two checks. The first check simply tells us whether the candidate text is actually a valid program in our programming language. This can be a simple true-false answer. For example, in Python, the text consisting of just the character A is not a valid program. However, the text consisting of just the character 1 is valid. This validation step is essentially running a compiler over a program that you wrote and having the compiler just give us a thumbs up or thumbs down. If the answer is positive, then the generated text is actually valid Python or whatever language. Then we perform the next check. Now, the next check is actually running the computer program that we just generated. We know it's valid, so we can run it. After the program runs, we check the output. If the output happens to be exactly the string we want, and in this example, the desired string is the first billion digits of pi, then we know that we found our computer program. And since we started with the shortest possible program and worked our way up, we know that the first program we find that gives us what we want is, by construction, the shortest possible program. Note that there might be other programs that also work that are the same length as our program, but none of them are shorter, since that would mean that our search would have stopped earlier. So this seems like a plausible approach. Maybe it's a bit impractical.
There's no way of knowing how long it will take. It could take an hour, or it could take 100 million years.
But we've already said that practicality was not a concern. So does this actually work? Can this algorithm that we just described, where we iteratively generate all possible strings of text from shortest to longest, and then filter out only strings that happen to be valid programs, and then run those programs until we find one that gives us what we want, is this a valid approach? Here we have to briefly revisit a topic discussed in the previous episode, specifically the so-called halting problem. The too long didn't listen summary is that it's impossible to construct an algorithm that can evaluate any computer program and its input and state whether the program will halt or run forever. Recall that it's trivial to construct programs that loop forever without exiting, and it's also very easy to write programs that run for a few steps and then stop. However, it is not at all trivial to examine a valid computer program and determine whether it is the type of program that will halt or the type that will run forever. Of course, for some programs, it's possible to do so by carefully examining the code. But in the general case, the halting problem is not computable. There's an elegant proof by contradiction that we discussed in episode 8. Go listen to that episode now before we continue. Did you listen to it? Good. So what this means for us and Dr. K is that although yes, we absolutely can generate these candidate pieces of text ordered by length, and then unambiguously decide which pieces of text are valid programs, however, we cannot take the next step, because some of the programs we generate will terminate quickly, while others will run for a long time, while yet others will run forever. And we cannot tell ahead of time which programs will run forever.
Is it done? Certainly not.
Which means the naive Kolmogorov complexity calculator will also run forever in some cases, and therefore is not guaranteed to give us a complexity metric for all possible strings. What if we tried something more sophisticated? Our naive attempt ran headfirst into the halting problem, but it doesn't mean there aren't other approaches that could bypass this limitation, right? Well, spoiler alert, it turns out that there is no algorithm, no matter how clever you get, that computes the Kolmogorov complexity for all strings. And to reiterate, computing this complexity means producing the number that is the length of the shortest possible program that generates a given string. So for example, given the string consisting of the first billion digits of pi, there might be a Python program that is exactly 1200 bytes long that emits those digits. And if that program happened to be the shortest possible program that can do this, we would say that the Kolmogorov complexity of the first billion digits of pi is 1200. Now, there is some hand-waving in this example, since the full analysis of complexity would also involve the size of the Python interpreter that runs that 1200-byte program, but we could just ignore that overhead for this discussion. So how do we actually prove that a general algorithm is impossible, or in other words, that the Kolmogorov complexity is not computable? Once again, the proof comes down to a contradiction, and that seems to happen a lot. So imagine, if you will, that a program for computing this complexity does exist. Instead of naive Kolmogorov complexity calculator, let's call this one the real Kolmogorov complexity calculator. Let's also pretend that we know how big this program is, and let's say it's a whopping 1 billion characters in some language.
$1 million.
As you will shortly see, we could have picked any value here, but let's just go for a billion for now. Now we will write a new computer program called StringFinder. StringFinder builds every possible string, starting with all the strings that are single character long, then two character strings, then three character strings, and so on. That sounds familiar, right?
Or does that confuse you?
For each string, we perform the following check. We feed the string to the routine that we had called the real Kolmogorov complexity calculator and look at the number that comes out. If the number is greater than, let's say, 2 billion, we stop our string finder program and return the string. Otherwise, we move on to the next string. So what exactly did we just do? Well, imagine that we run our string finder program for a while, and we can be really patient, and eventually it spits out some string with the Kolmogorov complexity greater than 2 billion. That means that in order to generate such a string, we need a computer program that is at least 2 billion characters long, and no program shorter than this can exist. But wait a minute, we just generated that exact string using a program that is just only a little bit longer than 1 billion characters. Recall that our program StringFinder internally uses the real Kolmogorov complexity calculator, so the overall program is at least 1 billion characters. That's how big the Kolmogorov piece is. On top of that, there are just a few hundred more characters to represent the StringFinder algorithm, which is just really a short piece of code with a couple of for loops. So the existence of the real Kolmogorov complexity calculator causes a contradiction. This insight has some other fascinating connections in computer science, such as the halting problem, as you already saw, the limits on compressibility of strings, as well as a fun little paradox that gets a lot of coverage in discussions of paradoxes. This is, of course, the Berry paradox, which is a type of paradox that arises from self-reference, which we, of course, love on this podcast. This paradox is attributed to a University of Oxford librarian, G.G. Berry.
He said it!
The paradox comes from the contradiction inherent in the following statement. The smallest positive integer that cannot be described in fewer than 20 English words. What would finding such an integer entail? What does it even mean to describe an integer in English? Well, simply stating the integer is one way. For example, 1530. That's an integer describable in 6 words. There might be a shorter description, for example, 30 more than 1500, which is only 5 words. We could also go with 170 times 9, which is only 4 words. But there's going to be some limit where we can't do it in fewer than so many words. So there must be some integers out there that cannot be described in fewer than 20 words, and amongst them we could find the smallest. But wait a minute, the very statement about the smallest positive integer in Berry's paradox is only 14 words long. So again, we have a contradiction. Of course, this paradox arises out of potential ambiguities of human languages. You can probably spend hours debating what it means for something to be, quote, describable. But in the Kolmogorov case, the proof by contradiction is perfectly logical and shows the incomputability of Kolmogorov complexity. Still with me? Thank you. When we started this episode with the passage from the Tao Te Ching, we briefly considered what it means to describe nature. Could such a description be more compact than nature itself? There is a strong temptation here to mix philosophy with science and try to analyze the describability of nature, for example, in terms of physics. For example, there are some cool concepts in physics like the holographic principle and the Bekenstein bound for the black hole entropy. And these are concerned in some way about how much information about a system can exist and how it relates to the actual size of the system. However, as cool as these concepts are, I suspect that going into the mathematical analysis of these is not going to provide deep personal insights into nature, and it would certainly take some of the poetry out of this ancient philosophical text. And as the book says, if nature is inexpressible, he who desires to know nature, as it is in itself, will not try to express it in words. Thank you as always for listening. The transcript of this episode is available at thebeyondpod.com. You can also email me at thebeyondpod@gmail.com to discuss this or any other meta topics of interest. Thanks again, and goodbye.